Good morning again. The court calls United States v. Weeks. Counsel for appellant, can you hear us in the back now? I understand there were some issues with that. Will you wave your hands or do something odd if you can't hear us? Okay, thank you. Better is not great. Can you hear? It's okay? All right, thank you.
Chief Judge Baker, honorable members of the court, may it please the court. The military judge abused his discretion by accepting appellant's guilty plea to forgery. There are three common elements to both kinds of forgery. Appellant only disputes one of these, and that is whether there was a writing falsely made. There was not a writing falsely made in this case, because each time appellant, each of the 31 times appellant called Best Buy to make payments, he gave his own name, not the name of Rondo Barco.
Would you agree there was a writing made?
Yes, Your Honor. In the stipulation of fact, it was, in fact, there was a writing, we know, not only from what was said during the care inquiry, during the providency inquiry, and from the stipulation of fact, although they sometimes refer to it as an electronic check, we know that there was an actual written check. Because if you look at Volume 2 of the Record of Trial, Article 32, Hearing Iowa Exhibit 5, we actually have a copy of all 31 checks there.
So you're centering on the fact that it was not falsely made.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Even though he didn't have Barber's permission to draw on that account.
Correct, Your Honor.
When he gave the information.
Correct.
Right. So why wasn't it falsely? Why was it not falsely made? Here's your writing. Pay to so many dollars, him, routing numbers from somebody else's account.
Well, it wasn't falsely made, Your Honor, because falsely made.
It purports to be a check from him on an account on which he is, if I can remember, I never can remember who is the drawer and who's the drawee. I think he's the drawer. The drawee's the bank. And he, in fact, and that, in fact, is false. He is not the drawer.
He's not the owner of the account.
He's not the owner of the account. He has no access to the account. The owner of the account has not given him access to it.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So why is not that a writing? Why is that not a writing falsely made?
Under the MCM, Your Honor, that's a genuine making of a false instrument. The instrument was false because he didn't own the account. But the writing was what it purported to be in the sense that it was signed by him. He did not sign it.
Is the genuine right making of a false instrument an offense under the code? And if so, what article?
The genuine making of a false instrument is an offense. It may be an offense under Article 121.
Okay, it's a larceny offense.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Honor. False is a term of art in Article 123 as MCM Part 4. Paragraph 48C2 explains, false refers not to the contents of the writing or the facts stated therein, but to the making or altering of it. It continues, forgery is not committed by the genuine making of a false instrument, even when made with the intent to defraud. And that was the case here. There was the intent to defraud.
I guess the question is whether or not this was a genuine making. And it seems to me that in order to be genuine, it had to be made either by the account holder or someone authorized. The fact that anybody can walk in off the street and use that number doesn't seem to me to be genuine.
Well, Your Honor, I think the MCM answers that question in 48C2. Gives an example to explain that sort of contradiction in terms, how you can have a genuine making of a false instrument. And it gives the example of signing my name to someone else's check, signing that person's name to his own check, to his check, and then signing my own name below it with the word buy in front. And that's effectively what happened in this case. Appellant effectively signed the check by Cody T. Weeks.
And how did he do that?
By giving his name over the phone.
Without putting buy. Without leading them or informing Best Buy that he was not the account holder, but that he was purportedly signing on behalf of the account holder.
Well, that did come up during the providency inquiry, Your Honor, and that's in the joint appendix at 32, lines 6 through 8. And the military judge asked him if he had stated that it was not his account. And he said that he could not because that wasn't an option. Either that during the conversation, because some of his calls were a conversation with a customer service representative, some were an automated payment system. Under either circumstance, apparently that wasn't an option, that wasn't a question he was asked. But he did say, this is Cody T. Weeks. And we know how the checks turned out because we can look at that IO Exhibit 5 and we know what it looked like. It didn't say on there, Rondé Barber in the lower right-hand corner. It said, buy retail services for Cody T. Weeks. So it was not a false representation of his identity. He did not purport to be someone else. He did not impersonate Rondé Barber. He signed the check in his own name, as that's reflected in that IO Exhibit 5.
So if you got a hold of my checkbook and signed your name to a check, in your view, then that would not be a crime if someone gave you money for it?
It would absolutely be a crime, Your Honor. It would be Article 121. It's larceny. But I'm not representing myself as Judge Ryan in that case. I'm representing myself with my own name.
What about 123A?
It might be an offense under Article 123A as well.
Or 134. failure to
294.
Failure to maintain a balance. That's a 134 offense.
True. And back to the 123A question.
Which sounds like your paradigm rather than 121.
Correct. And that is what the court came up with in a similar sort of case in U.S. v. Guess.
U.S. v. who?
Guess.
Guess. Okay.
We cited in a rule.
This is like Guess, is it not?
It's similar, Your Honor. Yes, sir.
Which is, and that was a 123A, was it not?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. It's different because in that case they were talking about blank starter checks, and in this case it was done over the phone. It's a little bit different. In that case, there was not enough. It looked like in the first four of the six checks, there was sufficient funds, and then after that, the bank account was empty. And so, slightly different question being addressed in Guess.
But even if you got printed checks, it's still a 123A offense, isn't it? You write a bunch of checks purporting to be you, and there's no money in the account. Isn't that a 123A offense?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
So this probably could have been charged under multiple articles, not just 121. That's fair. But it's still not a forgery under Article 123 because it's the genuine making of a false instrument. We also know, apart from what the checks said, we also know what the judge knew, the military judge knew about from the Providence inquiry. This is Joint Appendix at 28, lines 10 and 11. He said, appellant said, I provided name and address for all checks. All other information was the barber's. So even without the benefit of the IO exhibit, the military judge did know that he provided his own name and address, and that's how it was reflected in the printed out, the 31 checks that were printed out.
Let's stipulate solely for the purposes of the question that you're correct. What is it that this court should say that what needs to be clarified in the law that is not clear that prompts all of this? What is a clear statement of the principle of law that is at stake here?
Your Honor, Chief Judge, I think the law was clear. I think it just wasn't applied. And the problem was specifically that the military judge didn't ask enough questions to elicit the facts to show that there was no forgery. And
it's clear, and you find that clarity in the sentence, forgery is not committed by the genuine making of a false instrument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that what, in your view, is clear?
Yes, Your Honor. And it's clear because this court adopted that not only in Guess, when it was interpreting Article 123A, adopted that specific paragraph in the MCM, but it appears that Congress meant to adopt the language from the 1949 Article of War, because in the legislative history for UCMJ Article 123, it looked back to Article 93, it referenced Article 93, the old forgery statute, And it seems to have borrowed the language from the Army Manual for Court Martial 1949 and identifying elements in the current Article 123. So it seems that that old MCM was adopted by Congress in 1950 under the UCMJ.
Counsel, going back to the Chief Judge's question and the language in the manual, isn't there a distinction when you sign your own signature as the maker of a check, even though you don't have money or even an account? You're not trying to forge somebody else's, impose a legal liability on somebody else. Here, didn't your client impose a legal liability on his cousin, as well as the bank and as well as the Best Buy, whoever it was? In other words, he didn't send a check that says, this is my check. He sent a check that was represented, that was her check, and he represented it to be his check. There's a difference here, isn't there?
No, I disagree, Your Honor. It
goes back to, I guess, Judge Ryan's question. If you sign your name on her check, it's still forging that you have the right to draft money on her, to impose a legal liability on her.
Clearly,
that's the thing.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
I mean, isn't that the distinction?
I disagree, Your Honor.
Okay.
That makes it a false instrument. That means I have the intent to defraud Judge Ryan in this case. But that does not mean that it's a false making, because I'm still signing it with my own name. That's what makes it a forgery, is that I'm doing it in someone else's name, that I'm impersonating someone else. That didn't happen here, because the fraud was immediately obvious, because
you were impersonating that you had the right to do it.
I'm purporting, but that's what the instrument says on its face. That's why it's not a forgery, because the instrument says on its face, the fraud is clear from the face of the document. If you look at it and know that it is.
Well, what difference does it make if the fraud is evident from the face of the document? If it's fraud, it's fraud. I mean, whether it's obvious or not obvious, if as you say, it's obvious from the face of it, then it's fraud. It's just obvious fraud.
Well, it is fraud, and it is larceny, but it's not forgery, Your Honor. Because forgery requires something more specific. It requires impersonating someone else.
It's not fraud to represent that you have authority to draw on an account that is not your account.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, I guess your argument is that it wasn't falsely made. The falsely part of it.
Correct, Your Honor.
And I'm just having trouble getting by the fact that your client represented to Best Buy that this was an account that he had authority over. He used his own name, certainly, and he did not have authority. And I'm just having trouble trying to figure out why that wasn't a false representation.
It was a false representation.
So it was falsely made.
Not falsely made, because making refers not to the contents of the document, but to the signature, going back to the MCM, refers not to the contents of the writing or the facts stated therein, but to the making or altering. What was false here was the fact that he had ownership over the account. He did not falsely represent and say that he was that person.
You know, when I read this, I thought the problem with the case was there was no writing, at least by him. Wasn't all this done telephonically?
It was done telephonically.
I mean, he never signed anything personally, did he?
He did not, but he caused something to be written. But he's not a principal under Article 77B, because...
I mean, I thought the problem in the case when I first read the briefs was that we're trying to take the old common law of forgery and apply it to modern banking practices and that type of thing, and where it may not really fit, whereas Judge Stuckey points out it may really be a larceny by trick or something as opposed to forgery. Or there may be statutes, federal statutes, banking statutes that preclude this type of thing, like they had to do with credit cards.
Right. There are federal statutes, Your Honor, under the federal code, under Chapter 25, Chapter 47, Chapter 63 of the U.S. of 18 U.S.C., there are a lot of different ways this could have been charged. A lot of these have come about in the last 30 years or so. There's specific ways to charge electronic forgery. However, in this case, appellant caused physical writing to be made by making that phone call. We know that because we look at Iowa Exhibit 5 and there are physical checks that were ultimately made. But he's not a principal because what he wrote, if he had written it, what was printed on those checks, if he had written it himself, was not a forgery. And what he caused someone else to print out, Retail Services, Best Buy in this case, the parent company, was not a forgery. So the issue is not the electronic, the fact that it happened over the telephone. The issue is that it was not a forgery in either event, whether it was what Best Buy wrote or what he wrote on the checks. Either way, the check was what it purported to be. It was the genuine making of a false art, of a false instrument.
Well, let's say that we agree with you and think that you're right. What's your position as to whether your client can be retried for larceny on the same exact actions?
Our position is that he can be retried for larceny, Your Honor. The sentencing reassessment is appropriate. This charge should be set aside. Appellant should not be convicted for two crimes when he committed one. He should have been charged all along with $70,000 in larceny, not one for $50,000 larceny and another $20,000 for forgery. That's what's wrong here, is that he's been convicted of two crimes when he committed one.
He kind of got a break on that, didn't he? He really committed 25 or 30 crimes, and they charged this one.
Well,
by combining all the larcenies into one specification.
That's true, Your Honor. In that sense, he could have been charged 31 times, but for sentencing purposes, I think.
So was he, even if we decide that they screwed this up, was he prejudiced?
Yes, Your Honor, because appellant has two convictions where he should have had one.
Having the conviction is the prejudice?
Having a conviction for forgery is the prejudice.
Forgery is the prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
What's your legal argument that he can't be retried under larceny? I mean, does it constitute double jeopardy? Is it a fairness argument? What is it?
Did you say that, counsel?
I did not, Your Honor.
He said that he could be.
Oh, you
I
could be.
He
okay.
Could be. Yes,
all right, I'm sorry.
Oh, you said he could be?
You can't hear us in the back, but we can't hear each other either.
Yeah. I understood you to say the reverse.
I did, too. So your position is he could be?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And just to be clear, could he be tried on 123A?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
See, my time's expired. I'll save my remaining comments for rebuttal. Thank you.
Counsel to the government, please.
Thank you, Your Honor, Judge Baker, fellow members of this court, may it please the court. My name is Major Scott Jansen, and I, along with Mr. Gerald Bruce, represent the United States in this matter. The issue granted in this case is whether appellant's guilty plea to forgery by utterance was proper. This court reviews guilty pleas under an abuse of discretion standard to determine if there's a substantial basis in law of fact to question the appellant's guilty plea. In answering this probability question, there are really three sub-questions, and I'll only focus on one of them. There are three issues. One, whether the appellant admitted sufficient facts to support his guilty plea to forgery by uttering. Second, whether the electronic and creative checks were writings for purposes of Article 123, paragraph 2. And third, whether the electronic checks were falsely made. The appellant concedes the first two issues, so the United States, unless this court has any questions related to those, will focus its argument on whether or not the electronic checks were falsely made.
I don't think that the appellant conceded that he admitted sufficient facts. I think he said that the military judge didn't ask enough questions to elicit sufficient facts, unless I'm mistaken.
Your Honor, I believe that what the appellant was arguing that there was insufficient basis as a question of law related to whether or not there was the check was falsely made, not that the appellant admitted in his character to falsely making the checks. He 30 times there was a reference to checks being made, they're false, they're uttered, and then the stipulation of fact 15 or 18 times. So the appellant did admit those facts, and the question ultimately becomes whether or not what he did was whether the electronic checks were falsely made, that's more of a legal question.
What's the answer?
The answer to all three of those questions is yes, it was falsely made. As the appellant noted, the false is referenced in, the term false is referenced in the MCM as being not to the contents of the writing or the facts stated therein, but to the making or altering of it. And then it moves on to discuss that, talking about the genuine nature of the check. In this case, the check was not genuine because it purported to be the appellant was the owner of the check, and when in fact he was not, and that's what makes the check non-genuine. This court addressed the issue of whether or not this was a case of the appellant signing.
What would be a genuine making of a false instrument? Give us an example of how that language would apply then, because it sounds like a trap where anything that's false is therefore not genuine, but the manual makes a point of saying genuine making of a false instrument. So please create for me a genuine making of a false instrument for purposes of illustration.
Yes, Your Honor. I think, and that's why the MCM is trying to give some examples about the use of the word by in that situation. That didn't happen in this case because at no time did the appellant state that use the word by or purport that he was the victim's. He was reporting at all times to himself. And then it makes reference to the potential for charging under 123 alpha. And just because this case could have been charged many different ways does not answer the question whether or not this is a probable guilty plea to forgery by uttering. And this court discussed this issue in terms of the false nature of the writing in the Banfield decision in 1993, and this court held ultimately in a case in which the appellant signed his own name on a negotiable instrument. That was the guilty plea was a providence for all the checks, not just for the checks, including when he signed his own name. And this court discussed sort of the essence of forgery. It held, citing some earlier cases, that the essence of forgery is intent to defraud, and that the state of a mind in the intent to defraud involves a purpose or design to deprive a person of property or something of value by trick, deceit, chicanery, or overreaching. And that's exactly what happened in this case, by the appellant calling Best Buy and purporting that he was the lawful owner of the checking account, causing $19,000, or approximately $19,000 in money being lost to the victims and ultimately his benefit.
So you'd agree that that's larceny, right? As well, manslaughter.
Yes, sure. It could have been charged as larceny, but that's not the issue here. The issue is whether or not the statutory requirements were met for forgery. There was a writing, it was falsely made. It had legal efficacy. We know that because the check cleared, and we know that it was uttered because the check could not clear.
But I mean, it's not just, it doesn't just say falsely made, it's any signature, falsely makes any signature. That any person who falsely makes or alters any signature or any part of any writing which would have genuine apparently posed a legal liability, right? And so I think that Pelt would agree with you that if this had the actual account holder's name on it, that it would be a false writing, that it would be forgery. But it has his signature on it. I mean, it doesn't have his signature. It says by his authority.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that might be false, right, which is why it would be a larceny, but how is it a forgery?
It's forgery, Your Honor, because the instrument itself was falsely made, but purporting that was his...
That's circular. How do you address the distinction the appellant draws between the signature and the substantive contents of the instrument?
Does Article 123A or 123.1 restrict it to signature, or does it address any part of the document?
Your Honor, the United States asserts that it's referenced any part of the document, because this is a case of uttering a false writing. While the appellant did admit to the creation of it, he uttered it was a false writing because it wasn't genuine. He was not the lawful owner of the check.
So just to be clear, what on the Best Buy checks is false?
Well, Your Honor, fundamentally, what's false about it is just that he's the lawful owner of the check. As you look at the bottom where it has all the routing, but even more than that, the fact that, you know, just generally speaking, the checks did not belong to him at all. So a person who's creating, check numbers, the amount of it, you know, it didn't belong to him. So therefore, that, you know, again, purporting to be his money. Everything about the check, it is false, but most specifically and fundamentally, it's all the routing information, because when a bank is getting a check for processing, that the bank is focusing on who's going to pay. And who's going to pay is the owner of the account, which is annotated on the check. And so
what about in the discussion? 1.3, it says, a person who is intent on fraud signs that person's own signature as a maker of a check drawn at a bank in which the person does not have money or credit does not commit forgery. How is that not more similar to this? where he signed electronically, had his name placed on a check in an account that he didn't have any interest
on. Your Honor, the United States would again rely upon the Banfield decision, which just talked generally about the essence of forgery, and this court upheld the conviction in which the appellant signed his own name, and also relying upon the Army Corps, the Blackburn decision, where a conviction was upheld in which six traveler's checks, all signed by the accused, not signing as someone else, but signing as his own name, was upheld as being a lawful forgery conviction.
What was the name of the case?
That's the Blackburn decision, Army Court, 1976, which was also cited in our supplemental citation yesterday.
Can I just take this moment to ask about the supplemental citations of authority, because, and this isn't really just directed at you, it's just a general comment for the world. We keep on getting supplemental statements of authority, which my understanding in regular federal practice is for new authority that's been recently discovered, and we are continually getting citations of authority the day of or the day prior to arguments for cases from 1976 and much longer ago. Can you explain why that is?
Yes, Your Honor. The United States as we're preparing for trial, trying to have a better understanding of the legal argument we came upon those cases, we thought they were certainly helpful to our case, so we decided to cite it before the trial in accordance with this court's rules. And so we did that. We apologize for the late timing of it, but again, we do think that case is directly on point.
And again, you're not alone in this. I'm just saying that such authority and preparation, it would behoove all parties to do it well in advance of the day of or week of the arguments. It would be much more helpful to us.
Yes, Your Honor. We'll certainly take that under advice.
Counsel, you made quite a point in your brief that this is an uttering case and not a case under 123.1, although obviously there has to be a falsely made writing before you can get to the uttering.
Yes, sir.
Is there any distinction here as to whether or not it matters that he did or did not falsely make a writing if he's charged with uttering? I mean, can it just be a falsely made writing, I guess, is my question.
Yes, Your Honor. Under the UCMJ, he's not required to make it. So if he were to utter a document that he knew was false in some respects, then that satisfies the element of it being an uttering as they compare to the making of, which is, of course, a different type of forgery. But in this case, he uttered a check that he knew was false, a writing that he knew was false.
Now, where in the MCM does it address that?
Your Honor, it's not... case law provides that there are two types of utterings, and just a plain reading, and looking at just the elements where it says in the elements of forgery, the first element that a signature writing was falsely made or altered, which that is different than the element for forgery, which requires the accused to falsely make. Or alter certain signatures, right? So,
in order to be guilty of uttering, don't you need to have a false writing? I mean, basically, when you're taking a forged instrument and you're passing it on as if it were not a false instrument, correct?
Yes.
So, are we back to the same issue, which is what is the false instrument in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. That's fundamentally the issue because the forgery statute for uttering presupposes that there was a check that was, or an instrument or writing that was false. And so, again, it goes back to just the general, which is what the issue here, whether or not it's a false writing. And so, in the United States, believes the case law and just sort of a common understanding of what fraud or forgery is, which is, the fraudulent creation of a document that it is, that was falsely made.
Is it the United States' position that the statute's broad enough to cover this and we should simply disregard the manual? Because the manual seems to point in the appellant's direction.
Your Honor, the manual with respect to paragraph 2 isn't helpful. It's not inarticulately written, perhaps. But again, that's trying to explain sort of the definition of false. But the United States urges this court to look just plain at the plain statute. It is very
clear. Well. Are you saying that yes, that's your position?
Yes.
Okay. The manual, I think, takes cognizance of common law. Forgery was common law offense, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yeah. And we've been cited back to Cook on what forgery amounts to, and that also seems to point in the appellant's direction. So where are we?
Your Honor, where we're at is this court addressed the issue in the Banfield decision where they're talking about just the general nature and looking back at all through the history of forgery, and this court held that...
So basically, all we need to do to decide this case is cite Banfield and decide in your favor.
Yes, Your Honor. I think
Thank
this
you.
Court.
Envision two different scenarios. The first scenario, Weeks walks into Best Buy with a check that he's printed up that says Weeks, and it has a false routing number. And a false accounting number. He signs it Weeks, mm-hmm. presents it. The second one, he comes in with a check that he's printed up that says Weeks, and it's got his cousin's routing number and account number and signed Weeks. He presents it right there, both checks. Is he guilty of forgery in the first instance?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, can you please ask the question?
I'm trying to unravel this genuine making of a false instrument. If I write out a check that says Walter Cox and put a fictitious routing number and a fictitious account and sign it Walter Cox and walk in and give them my ID and they take it,
mm-hmm. That'd be
that's larceny, isn't it, by trick. It's not forgery. Who have I prejudiced? On the other hand, if I walk in with Walter Cox and it's got Judge Stuckey's routing number and account number and I sign it Walter Cox and present it, I've prejudiced him, and that is forgery.
Yes, Your Honor.
Even though it's a genuine making, I sat there and genuinely made it. I don't know what the heck that means, but sounds like something the Mad Hatter would say in Alice in Wonderland.
Yes, Your Honor. And the latter example you gave is the fact pattern of this case in which the appellant...
See, I thought the problem in this case was the appellant never did anything like that. He just called him on the telephone. He never uttered, he never presented, he never wrote. He stole it. He cheated him. There's no doubt about that. But.
Your Honor, I don't think a bank would be in business very long if they were paying on checks that didn't, there was no writing associated with it.
Best Buy is still in business.
Counsel, let me ask you.
Well, they do, you know, power companies do drafts on your account, telephone companies. People draft accounts all the time. If I go to the power company and say draft on my account and it happens to be Judge Sticker's account, is that forgery or is it enforced?
Your Honor, if a writing was created, then it would be forgery. In this case, there was a writing created, and the appellant admitted to it. There's an IO exhibit that makes clear that this is a check. This is not just a telephone conversation. If something actually then subsequent to that occurred, then it was uttered. So does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Okay. If there are no further questions, I may briefly conclude. Your Honor, appellant's guilty plea to forgery was provident. Appellant admitted sufficient facts supporting his guilty plea to forgery. Moreover, the 31 electronic checks appellant uttered satisfied the statutory requirements of Article 123, Section 2, to include the writing of falsely made elements according to the United States. Respectfully request this Court uphold appellant's guilty plea.
Thank you, counsel. Appellant, would you like to do rebuttal?
Counsel, before you get going, I'd like to take a look at the plain language of Article 123.1, if we could, and not look at the manual language or anything there. And that language states that any person who falsely makes any part of any writing, which, if genuine, would cause a legal obligation. Now, why doesn't that apply in this case? Just looking at those words, the literal words of the statute. I mean, you've admitted that he falsely made it. Obviously, you've admitted that it's a writing. You're relying on this language in the manual, the discussion about the false document genuinely made. But let's just take a look at the actual language in the statute itself.
Your Honor, it's back to when Congress adopted this in 1950. They adopted that commentary from the Army MCM.
No. I'm not talking about the commentary. I'm talking about the language of the statute.
Yes, Your Honor. It would seem from the face of the language on the statute that that's the meaning. However, when Congress adopted that, they adopted that 1949 commentary that's right here that explains what that language means. Congress.
Well, what does that language mean? How do you genuinely make a what is the language? Genuinely make a false document? What is that specific language?
Just like the facts of this case, where appellant.
The genuine making of a false instrument. How can you genuinely make a false instrument?
He stole money that wasn't his, but he did not purport to be somebody else. That's how you do it. Just like the facts in this case. He did not purport to be Rondé Barber.
The problem with that, though, is that puts it into the larceny camp, in your view. But the forgery section is also intended to get at the issue of imposing a legal liability on another. So how does your scenario protect society's interest in imposing a legal liability on another?
I think, Your Honor, I would disagree that imposing a legal liability on another is necessarily the purpose. That's one of the elements of forgery, one of the three common elements of both aspects of forgery. A false making, a legal liability, and an intent to defraud. And we would agree that there was a legal liability imposed and there was an intent to defraud. We do not agree, however, that there was a writing falsely made because it was genuine. It did not purport to be someone who was not.
I understand that argument.
Is there any further questions?
Well, you...
Yeah, I think I'm done.
Okay. Do you wish to summarize, or you're not required to?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The court counts both counsel, thanks both counsel, among other things. And we stand in recess until further order of the court, which will be tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Court stands in recess until 9:30 a.m.